loneliness and social isolation have been hitting people harder than ever, but it's especially difficult for our seniors. We're looking at this problem here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers have found chronic loneliness can shorten a life. It can accelerate dementia, anxiety, and issues with physical health. They found loneliness can have a negative effect on seniors' immune systems, making them more vulnerable to illness. Do you have a family member who's homebound or living in a nursing home? How have you been communicating with them? Are you worried about isolation, about the connections lost? We're at 800-642-1234. Julianne Holt-Lunstad is a psychology and neuroscience professor at Brigham Young University, where her research focuses on the long-term health effects of loneliness and social isolation. Julianne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So the World Health Organization declared a worldwide pandemic on March 11th, more than 7 months ago, and suddenly so much of our world was homebound. Was this isolation eye-opening?
Oh, I think that this has really brought a lot of attention to the critical importance of contact with others, our social relationships, and just how important it is to our emotional well-being. And I hope others are starting to recognize the importance for our physical health also.
And so there was already a loneliness epidemic prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Are you concerned at all about how the current situation compounds what was already so problematic for so many Americans?
Yeah, we already had some evidence to suggest that a large portion of the population was either socially isolated, lonely, or both. And with the restrictions and recommendations that limit social contact, there certainly is concern that not only that the prevalence rates may potentially increase, but that this may make an issue that's already a problem for some, a more severe problem.
Well, let's make sure that we understand our definitions, because this is something that I'm sure you see a lot.
Yeah.
That, you know, we use the word social isolation and loneliness interchangeably, not correctly, though. So can you explain what exactly are the definitions we're looking at here?
Thank you for asking that. Yes, these are different terms. Social isolation is thought to be more objective and loneliness more subjective. So social isolation is having few or infrequent social contacts or social relationships, whereas loneliness is more the feeling alone, whereas loneliness is actually being alone. Only feeling alone, and social isolation is actually being alone. And so loneliness is often defined as the discrepancy between one's actual and desired level of social connection. And so the social isolation and loneliness can often co-occur. Certainly being alone increases our risk of feeling alone, but we can all think of examples where we have been alone, but not feel lonely. We might actually take pleasure in our solitude, and also times where we're surrounded by others, where we're not isolated, but yet feel profoundly lonely. And so it's important to distinguish these two, because sometimes they can occur not together.
We're talking with Julianne Holt-Lunstad, who's a psychology and neuroscience professor at Brigham Young University, where she studies the effects of isolation and loneliness. And you can join in. Do you work in a nursing home? Is it understaffed? How are you working to care for the mental health of residents in this pandemic? What precautions must visitors take? And how are your residents doing? Join in at 800-642-1234. Julianne, there are currently 527 active COVID investigations in our long-term care facilities here in Wisconsin. How do COVID outbreaks affect the mental health and well-being of nursing home residents in these facilities?
That's a great question, and one, of course, that we're still trying to really get clear answers on. There have been a number of surveys that are aimed at looking at how this is impacting various populations, and some of which are focused specifically on older adults, but not all of them are specific to those who are living in nursing homes, assisted living, memory care, other kinds of residential settings that are perhaps most impacted during this time, as of course, those living in residential settings are at greatest risk and may have the tightest restrictions.
Yeah, and so you really have to watch the research there as to what's happening, because we saw
right.
we saw that CDC data that showing that deaths from dementia have spiked this year. What do you think is going on?
So there might be a couple of explanations. One is the possibility that individuals may be less likely to seek out care that they may need because of the fear of going into a hospital and potentially contracting COVID. There could also be if one is living in, say, a residential setting like a memory care, it's really difficult to socially distance for someone who has dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And so the same kinds of precautions that others might be able to take may be much more difficult in these situations. And so infection rates may be higher among this group as well.
Why is it hard to social distance in memory care?
There may be confusion, not understanding that you can't do the normal activities you might normally do, not understanding or remembering that you need to wear a mask, that you're not supposed to leave your apartment or you're not supposed to get close to others. These are not activities or modes of behavior that have been a part of you know, any of our lives for that matter, for any length of time. And so this is something that's new. And so that may be really difficult to understand. And
it might be really scary, I would imagine, for someone to see someone in full PPE when they're, you know, being attended to, whether that's through feeding or for getting dressed and in the, you know, daily living situation, that, you know, PPE can be scary in itself.
Oh, absolutely. So that can increase anxiety, certainly.
Talking with Julianne Holt-Ludenstad, who is a psychology and neuroscience professor at Brigham Young. She's helping us understand just how detrimental social isolation can be to our well-being and what those next steps look like. Have you visited an elderly family member recently face-to-face, or maybe it was by talking to them through a window? Can you share with us your interactions? What creative ways are you using to check on elderly family members in this pandemic? And all people, including your friends, join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Julianne Holt-Ludenstad on the Ideas Network. We're discussing social isolation and loneliness here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The AARP published a social isolation report this month. Two-thirds of adults surveyed say they are experiencing social isolation. More than half say their anxiety levels have increased during the pandemic. But AARP says many are not turning to anyone for help. Do you work in a long-term care facility or help in-home health for homebound seniors? What are you noticing? How are you working to care for your residents or your clients? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Brigham Young University psychology professor Julianne Holt-Lundstad, who has extensive research in this area, and she stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in Annalisa, who's joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Annalisa. What is your situation like?
My situation is that my partner is in assisted living, and I cannot visit him. He's had some setbacks. He's had a bout of pneumonia and so forth. I cannot visit. I do talk to him on the phone, and they help him set up FaceTime. We've done that a couple of times. But it's just very hard. My kids don't live here. I have a lot of friends, but it's just very hard when you can't visit to see how the person is doing yourself. I just can't describe just how difficult that is. So I really appreciate this program. Thank you.
Julianne, what can you tell Annalisa with that? So, such a difficult situation.
And thank you. First off, I just want to, give my deepest empathy to Annalisa. I think she's not alone. There are many who are in similar situations, and it's tough. And so, of course, there's concern about not only Annalisa, but Annalisa's partner, both individuals' well-being. While I don't know all the details of her partner's situation, one thing that she did mention is that she is able to talk to her partner on the phone and use FaceTime. Some of the research has shown that that phone calls and making that emotional connection can certainly both help both individuals' stress levels and anxiety levels and help strengthen those social bonds. I know that there are some assisted living centers that are starting to get creative and think of ways that people can safely visit, whether it's from a porch or through plexiglass or some form of keeping some kind of distance to still help protect individuals from spreading the virus, but yet still allow some kind of contact. Some facilities may be implementing some of these, but what it really suggests is that we've got to really be creative because we certainly do need human contact, but we can't trade that, of course, by putting people we love at risk. And so these creative solutions absolutely are needed.
Yeah, because, the phone calls and the FaceTimes can only go on for so long. At some point, you need to be able to touch the person you love.
Right. So there's actually a local senior living center here in Utah that has what they call conversation stations, and they have tables and chairs set out in a little beautiful courtyard and have plexiglass in between, but they actually have cut a little opening so that family members can hold the hand of the resident. And, they, of course, encourage using hand sanitizer before and after, but at least there's that moment of not only being able to see your loved one in person, but actually touch them and hold their hand, because that's one thing that I hear over and over again, is this craving for human touch and missing that.
We're talking with Julianne Holt-Lunstad, who's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, and we're looking at the effects of social isolation and loneliness in the pandemic. What can happen going forward? How are you connecting with a loved one who has to be isolated right now? What is that like? How are you getting through to them and feeling connected? Join in at 800-642-1234. Julianne, you know, it seems like these conversation stations could be set up in a number of places that they could help break down these barriers that are, you know, people feeling. Even when you're trying to talk through a window, it's not enough. Why isn't it enough to be able to just see someone?
Oh, gosh. You know, first of all, I think, you know, one of the things that you just mentioned is, you know, these conversation stations. And, you know, here in Utah, it's starting to get cold, and we just had snow yesterday. And I actually grew up in the Twin Cities of Minnesota, just over the border from Wisconsin. And so I know how brutal the winters can get in the Midwest. And so that adds another challenge, of course, of trying to really address or find ways to connect in person when doing it outside becomes even more challenging, right? And we know from evidence that we have decades and decades of studies that show that in-person contact has been linked to all of you know, the health outcomes that you mentioned, including reduced risk for chronic illnesses and even reduced risk for earlier death. And so we know that this has such important effects. But the big question we have now is how well connecting remotely is going to work, because we don't have as much evidence on some of these more digital means of connection.
When you look at the research, your research on social isolation, loneliness, and the risks of mortality and lifespan, and you've learned that being socially isolated carries the same health risk as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. What do you see there in terms of mortality and social isolation?
Yeah, so first off, I think it might help to contextualize that, because for some people that may be difficult to understand. And really this that evidence comes from, we gathered all of the evidence available worldwide and were able to combine that data and analyze it. And what we found was that being socially connected actually increases our survival by 50%. But we knew that people wouldn't understand what that meant. And so we benchmarked it relative to other factors that we know carry an influence on how long we live. And so, you know, if we inverse that, lacking social connection, when we benchmark it, was not only comparable to smoking up to 15 cigarettes per day, but it exceeded many of these other factors, including things like obesity, physical inactivity, and air pollution. And so what this data suggests is that our social connections are an important part of a healthy lifestyle, just like being physically active is important for a healthy lifestyle, and that this is something that we need to take very seriously for our health, just like we take some of these other factors seriously for our health.
If we have a loved one in memory care who can no longer recognize us, how does that influence these Zoom conversations and these FaceTime calls and these phone calls? Because I would imagine that's very difficult. The person would be very confused.
Right. And that's really
First off, I wish that I had more evidence and data to share with you on that, because what's unfortunate is those who are most vulnerable and most at risk are also the hardest to study. And so we are, and that doesn't mean that we don't have evidence, but that we're still trying to understand how this is impacting individuals with cognitive impairment, dementia, and Alzheimer's disease. But we believe that there are still important effects that really that we are, as humans, social beings, and that this is part of our biology. Mm. And that we really, truly need human contact.
Well, let's pause there with Julianne Holt-Lunstad, who studies the long-term health effects of social isolation. She's a professor at Brigham Young University. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on social isolation and loneliness and the physical health consequences amid the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about the CDC. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported a spike in dementia-related deaths between February and October when compared to data from past years. And so one of the burning questions is, can this be linked to a disruption to care as people living with dementia are highly reliant on caregivers? And what effect do visitor restrictions and lockdowns have on the progression of memory decline? Join in with your thoughts, your situation, 800-642-1234. We have Julianne Holt-Lunstad, who's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, and she's our guide. Let's bring in Kathleen, who is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Kathleen. What are you experiencing?
Thank you so much for taking my call. And I am seeing a dramatic crisis. And my husband has Alzheimer's. He is in a very competent and caring, secured dementia unit within a regular nursing home. And I have not been with him since March. And this is beyond visitation, this crisis. And I want to stress, the staff, the nurses, the CNAs, the administration are magnificent. Their hands are tied by very out of aligned regulation that I'm just so overwhelmed and distraught by it. What I have seen, 4 times a week, I go to the window of my husband's room, and a staff member has to bring him to the window because he is not able to follow direction, and he also cannot have conversation. But what I did before COVID, 5 to 7 days a week, is I would go during the time that he was in stress and anxiety, kind of that sundowning time, and I would redirect and comfort him the way I had been taught through the Alzheimer's Association, and it worked beautifully, and he had a great sense of home and place at the care center before COVID, and he was wonderful except for those 3 hours a day. So I was not visiting him. I was an essential caregiver. In the state of Minnesota, they have provisions for that. In the state of Wisconsin, they do not allow it. And what has happened is I have seen the regular nursing home residents, as I wait to give his snack to an outside attendant, I see their physical, emotional changes in terms of their demeanor, their faces, their ways they interact with each other. They are depressed and anxious. Mm. And then when I'm waiting to see my husband through the glass, and while he has his snack on the other side of the glass, a staff member holds the phone, and I have my phone. I see the members, the other residents in the dementia unit, as they walk past, and again, dramatic deterioration in their affect, their mood, their physical appearance. So I believe, and my husband, sadly, as I saw him deteriorate over the months, be more frightened, more anxious, more harder to connect and engage with at the window, his began to deteriorate. He ended up having to be taken out. He melted down And he is an ambulatory man who has a physical strength. And he melted down, and emotionally it got worse every week, and he was removed by the police and taken to the emergency room. And he was 20 days in the hospital before a treatment plan. Again, more and more reliance on increasing medications is the only option. And I cannot stress enough, the staff are amazing, but their hands are tied.
Julianne, I want to bring you in here on these observations. And this notion, Kathleen says, that family are essential caregivers in these situations.
Yes, family and friends, and particularly family, are a major source of support and caregiving for older adults, and particularly older adults with dementia. And Kathleen, I really just empathize with your situation. Caregiving is challenging under normal circumstances, and we have very good data on that prior to the pandemic. And as she has very clearly and thoughtfully articulated, there are a number of critical challenges that are now faced. One point that she brought up was that there are differences even from state to state. And I did want to note that the National Academy of Sciences has been charged with a new report to look at the quality of care in nursing homes. And I understand that memory care and assisted living and independent living are different than nursing homes. But this begins a start to that can lead to more recommendations around standardization of quality of care across these different kinds of senior living situations, which has been prompted by the pandemic and the importance for the real need to have evidence-based recommendations around the quality of care in these living situations.
Do you think that research and those recommendations going forward are going to change our approach to how we care for residents in these homes?
Well, my hope is that is the case. So I recently also participated on another National Academy of Science committee around social isolation and loneliness in older adults. And we are already starting to see how some of our recommendations are being implemented. But of course, these are recommendations. And so there no organization or institution or government is in any way tied to these recommendations. But nonetheless, they do provide a framework for such decisions to be made, and so that they can be made based on the best available evidence as well as expert consensus around that evidence.
You know, I mean, it's one thing to say a facility is meeting the needs of the resident because they are being fed and bathed and clothed and they have all those basic needs taken care of. But one of that big, big need is someone to be there for them and be able to keep them company and to be able to
Absolutely.
Interact. And that is a huge piece of that care.
Absolutely. And emotional well-being, social well-being, that is just as critical as their physical well-being. And so a holistic approach absolutely is needed. And I couldn't agree more.
We're discussing the health effects of social isolation and loneliness with Julianne Holt-Lunstad, who's a professor at Brigham Young University in Utah. And hearing your situations about caring for a loved one from afar, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Julianne, if you are homebound at any age in the spectrum, what can you do in your day to stave off loneliness?
That's a great question. And so we have been looking at some of the ways in which people can connect. And so, you know, as you said, at any age, and we've all, one thing about this pandemic is that it's all given us all a small glimpse into what it's like to be homebound. As most of us, at least even temporarily, had some kind of lockdown or stay-at-home order during this pandemic. And so some of the research that we have found is that those who are able to stay in contact with friends and family are coping better. Interestingly, the healthy aging poll recently found that those who are also eating healthy, getting exercise, and getting enough sleep also were reporting less loneliness. Also, during the pandemic, the same study found that older adults who interacted with people in their neighborhood or spent time outdoors, even just a few times a week, were less likely to feel lonely than those who did not. But interestingly, when it came to video chat, what they found was that although 31% of older adults had used video chat to interact with family and friends, there was no difference in loneliness between those who used video chat and those who did not.
Wow.
And in some of my own research, we found that at least among older adults, that phone calls were the primary means of connecting socially. But ultimately, really what it's all about is still maintaining those emotional connections to those that you love. So whether you can do it safely, you know, from a porch or over the phone, checking in on people, letting them know you care about them, letting them know how grateful you are for them. Research shows that expressions of gratitude not only increase social bonding, but also reduce loneliness. So these small gestures can really not only communicate care, but what we found is physiologically that when we feel like we can count on others, we have trusted others in our lives, that we view our environment and our situation as less challenging. And that this that can help mitigate some of the physiological responses that we would otherwise have to stressful, challenging situations, with these increases in blood pressure and heart rate and circulating stress hormones and inflammation. And of course, inflammation can exacerbate emotional, cognitive, and physical conditions.
All connected together. Pausing there with psychologist Julianne Holt-Lundstad, whose research focuses on long-term health effects and social connection. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Julianne Holt-Lundstad as we look at the effects of loneliness and isolation and where to go from here. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. Studies have found that social isolation can really have devastating effects on our health, on our quality of life. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rod in Cottage Grove. Hi, Rod.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I thought I'd touch base with you because the doctor talked about getting outside and lowering sundowners by exposure to daylight. We're in the middle of a study right now where anecdotal evidence indicates that we've had a very positive effect with lowering sundowners, and that's based on using specified light spectrum during the day versus the evening, we're giving them a day-night cycle with man-made light versus natural sunlight. And we've had very positive effects so far, but we won't be able to talk about numbers or data until the study is complete. But anecdotally, it's been positive.
Rod, thanks. Julianne, any insights there on regulating someone's exposure to light as part of helping them, you know, get through difficult memory issues?
So first of all, I'm so glad that researchers like Rod are out there. This is a bit outside of the area that I research. And so I'm certainly grateful to other researchers, because of course this is an incredibly complex issue, and we need complex solutions, and we need experts from a variety of disciplines to all work together. And I think, you know, one of the things that this pandemic has really illustrated is the coming together of experts to really share data and, you know, trying to come up with these interdisciplinary kinds of solutions, because while, you know, light therapy might be well outside of my area of expertise, clearly it applies to those who may be experiencing social isolation and loneliness, among those with dementia, whereas my research focuses more on physical health in terms of mortality and morbidity, but they all come together. They're all related.
I want to go back to something you said about the research showing that video chats aren't really moving the needle at all on social isolation. And what role do you think does social media have in feelings of loneliness and social isolation?
Well, first, I should clarify that this is one study.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure,
one of the things that we always want to make sure is that we have cumulative evidence and converging evidence, so that as we get more studies that look at different samples, are they all pointing in the same direction? And so this is, you know, from the National Poll on Healthy Aging out of Michigan. And so in this same study, they looked at social media use. And what was interesting is that they did find that a significant number of older adults did use social media. In fact, they report 59% connected with family, friends over social media. But what was interesting is that they found that that was actually associated with greater loneliness rather than reduced loneliness. And so again, this is just one study, and part of a growing body of research that is really trying to understand the broader implications of connecting via social media, but also broader means of connecting digitally at a distance. And to what extent can this tap into the pathways that we know can help us feel connected to others? And the evidence right now is quite mixed, and some actually suggest that there may be some negative consequences. And so we, you know, there it depends on how it's used and who are using it. And so I do want to make sure that, you know, it's understood that this is very complex, so I don't want to paint it as all good or all bad, but rather we do need to be very careful, and that we also recognize that when it might be elevating distress. So if you find that your time spent on social media is increasing either anxiety from seeing news features being shared on social media, or feelings of exclusion, that perhaps, you know, that's an indicator to limit time. But the evidence that shows that it may have some benefit is really around active use of connecting. And mm-hmm. so if you're going to use social media, use it in a way that helps you feel more connected and bonded to those that you care about.
We're talking with Julianne Holt-Lunstad of Brigham Young University, where she researches the long-term health effects of social connection. And we're at 800-642-1234. Julianne, let's circle back to where we started 7 months into the pandemic. And I know so many people out there want some creative approaches because we don't know how long we're going to be in the situation where a loved one is having a difficult time because they cannot connect with the people they care about all around them. So how would you say that we can approach conversations with care facilities about thinking out of the box to be able to make these connections and help our loved ones feel better?
You know, I've actually been thinking about this a lot. My sister works at a senior living center that includes independent, assisted, and memory care, and so we've had lots of conversations around creative solutions. And so I also want to just acknowledge that I understand the challenges that these facilities and organizations and staff face as well. And so, you know, there is that balance there. But we certainly can be more creative. And so I know that one way that this is being explored is around pool testing for the virus to allow residents more freedom because in many cases, if residents have to leave for, say, a doctor visit, they have to quarantine when they come back. And so many families are starting to think about how are we going to handle the holidays?
Mm-hmm.
And how are we going to be able to see our loved ones? And so certainly, you know, some are considering whether to, take their loved ones out during the holidays. They may need to quarantine when they come back. But of course, this, you know, should be very carefully considered. The one thing that we do see is that many of these facilities are doing really great job of trying to come up with creative solutions. So, you know, parades that go by, allowing residents out in the courtyard and developing activities that help still maintain distance between individuals so they can still have interactions with others even in where, you know, where they live.
Yeah.
And so we just really have to, you know, continue thinking about what can be safely done.
Julianne, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Julianne Holt-Lunstad is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. Just ahead, how are the most contentious Senate races going around the country and what could they mean for the Senate going forward? 1A has a Senate race roundup that's coming up next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.